There's a little-known part of Hollywood that most people are not aware of, known as the audience test preview. The recently released book, Audienceology, reveals this for the first time. Our podcast series, Don't Kill the Messenger, brings this book to life, taking a peek behind the curtain. And now, join author and entertainment research expert, Kevin Getz.
In 2016, my company Screen Engine partnered with my guest today to initiate a change in the way that entertainment audiences are tracked, reached, and marketed to by emphasizing their interests, beliefs, values, and behaviors rather than simply by their age, gender, race, and ethnicity demographic information. This is one of the wheelhouses of Melva Benoit, a trailblazer in research and consumer insights and president of the Marion Dupree Group. Her rich background includes leadership roles with major companies like Disney, NBC, and Fox. Melva, I'm really happy to have you here today.
I'm excited to be here.
Before we get into a lot of stuff, you are one of my first mostly television-centric guests, as you pointed out before the interview today. And I think it's important for people to know that Don't Kill the Messenger not only applies to people in the movie business, but certainly also in television. You've had to deliver the news on pilots, tracking information, promo information, and ad sales throughout your career. Would you concur that that is a very apt title, Don't Kill the Messenger?
It is. Being a pure television market researcher for probably the first 20 years of my career, the nickname was Show Killer. Oh, the show killer's coming in. And it's like, I'm not the show killer. It's like, I need your show to work just like you need your show to work because I have kids to feed. So let's sort of figure it out together.
I don't understand why they would think that you have some pleasure in or a Schadenfreude or something that you want them to not succeed. If you had everything succeeding, your life would be so easy.
Exactly. Well, my beginning was in basic cable. And so specifically, though, it was kids. And so when you're testing content with kids, kids are brutal. They're very clear on what they like and what they don't
like. Did you actually moderate groups yourself or have a hands-on approach?
My very first time moderating was actually a brief stint while doing kids. I took a gig at Comedy Central. And so the groups I moderated were for a small show you may have heard about. It's my first time moderating, called South Park.
I heard that little show. Yeah.
Oh, God. So
that wasn't a kid's show.
No. Comedy Central. So I've been very lucky in that. Starting in basic cable with brands, I got to build a brand. I was employee number 14 out of 19 for Cartoon Network. So we were the little engine that could when Nickelodeon was the dominant player. And so they were everything from a brand with regard to kids. So I started in market research and television in a space where there weren't a lot of people. So I wouldn't get pushback if I was doing something new. So I had the freedom to learn, to innovate, to do, to change, because we were the second brand. I can remember sitting at a meeting in New York for the kids up front.
Explain what the upfronts are.
So every year before the new season, all of the networks would get together in New York and they'd have parties and introduce the schedule for the fall.
They'd be pretty lavish shows, right?
Correct. Historically, it was built around that's when the new cars were being brought out onto the assembly line.
Oh,
so television,
that's how the cadence of
correct,
that time?
It's about advertising at the end of the day. It's not about the show. It's about advertising. And so that was built around the new cars are coming out in the fall and – auto was the largest category. That was the most amount of money spent across advertising.
Put a pin in that for a second. And then movies became one of the largest, if
correct,
not the largest, which prompted you when you were at NBC to begin
Must-See TV.
Must-See TV on Thursday was because movies opened on Friday.
Correct.
And Thursday was a huge advertising final push for weekend movies. And there was a fortune spent on linear television at
that
point,
right? It was enormous because it was the beginning of the weekend. NBC is Must-See TV. That's actually Preston Beckman, my mentor's creation. They had two comedy nights Tuesday. They called it the Twin Towers, Tuesday and Thursday. But Thursday was Cosby. It was Seinfeld at one period of time. It was all of this. When Cosby was on the air. So we go all the way back to the 80s.
You were there then?
No. I was in college. So there was no digital. We're not into cell phones yet. If you think about it, the way ratings work, 90% of households, if they were on in America, were tuned to Cosby.
Well, what was the share?
They were doing like a 70 share. So it was.
Listeners, listen to this. Melba, what does a Super Bowl do today?
It's not what it used to be.
Ish.
Maybe a 10 rating if they can get there.
And Cosby was a what?
Cosby was double or triple that at some point.
It's just beyond staggering to think that there were three networks. Fox didn't exist yet.
No, I wrote a paper about Fox actually in college and then ended up working there because they were
You ran the entire research and strategy group.
They announced themselves as I was coming out of college. And it was this sort of interesting exercise that they were going to do.
There's so many things I want to ask you. So first of all, where'd you grow up?
So I grew up in Houston, Texas.
Okay.
Born and raised.
Loved television as a kid?
Loved television as a kid. And my desire was to be in charge of Saturday morning cartoons. I loved cartoons.
Favorite cartoon?
Favorite cartoon is the Jetsons. Loved animation, loved cartoons. So I grew up in a household, two-parent household. My mother was a school teacher. She loved the arts. So many weekends spent in museums with art, going to the theater. And I took ballet from 8 to 18. And my ballet teacher, who was black, was one of the first prima ballerinas at the Sorbonne, black woman. So that's sort of my history growing up and my tie to art and storytelling.
You know, I've known you for how many years?
And you didn't know that. There's so much that goes into – my children would complain. It's like, look, you have to take every lesson that I had to take. You only know I'm from Texas if I have enough bourbon. And it's like,
What does Mike come through with me? My Brooklyn.
Exactly.
So suddenly I'm like, yeah. Was that soft? Was that a big dog or what?
Exactly. So my mother decided I was going to go to Howard when I was, I don't know, 8 or 9. We went to Washington, D.C. for the weekend. My dad worked for an airline, Braniff. So we flew quite a bit. My dad wanted me to be an engineer. And so I spent summers in engineering camps. And I...
Oh, isn't that funny? They want to push you.
My mother wanted me to be an actress. And so I took a lot of voice. My acting classes were at Theater Under the Stars. So I'm in the only nearly all white production of The Wiz called Dorothy is Alive and Well.
Oh, no, they did not do that.
Yes, Dorothy is Alive and Well and Living in Oz.
I think of home, I think of a place where there's love overflowing.
So I was in charge of the Poppy Field, and we did four productions.
Oh my
I remember
God.
This. I did stand-up in New York for a brief moment.
So interesting. And it's good for our listeners to know, Melba is so respected in the – probably you have one of the longest reigns of any television executive in research and strategy. And to have this background just absolutely exemplifies – and highlights what I call finding your and, which is, of course, your superpower, which you have, which is innately what you are and who you are.
Mm-hmm.
But that throughout your life, you bring these different ands into play to form the woman or the man that you become.
Yes. Yes, completely.
Incredible.
My journey into research wasn't specific. My boss at King World just put me in research. And then that began the path and – I developed a career around understanding, well, I couldn't necessarily create. I could have a conversation with creatives and I look at data and I see pictures.
Au contraire. How could you not say that? That's why I think now it makes sense to me why I consider you one of the best that I've ever worked with. And that has to do with the fact that you are creative. And I believe in my heart that the best marketing people, the best market research people are in fact creative beings. They can be empathetic, not just give scorecards and be called dream killers or whatever the hell we are called,
right?
But rather really contributing to the process.
Right.
I mean, you have worked with people who found you invaluable. You've worked with people who also thought you were probably a pain in the ass like I get as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is you're – contributing the impact of the audience, the viewpoint of the audience, and being that advocate for a voice that's never heard.
Right.
And that takes great creativity.
Ever wondered what it takes to make it in the movie business? Peel back the curtain with 4-6 Success Filmmaking. 4-6 Success Filmmaking is where filmmakers share their stories and the secrets.
It's beyond competitive out there.
There have been movies that it's taken me 10 years to get made.
Don't wait to create. Like, you've got to just keep making stuff.
Tune in to 4-6 Success Filmmaking for your dose of cinematic realness, direct from the voices that have lived it.
Oh, thank you. I never really thought about it that way. You know, when research inside of a media institution works really well, I tell people we do three things. Because some people look at the research department as a utility. It's a cost center. It's not driving revenue. And it's like, yeah, but if you do this right, you're having an impact against revenue. And you tell those stories, right? So the first thing that we do is we do the things that have to be done no matter what. It's keeping the lights on. So I describe it, if we were diner. Every day we get up and we make mixes for pancakes and for other things because we know people are going to come in and they're going to want those sort of standard things. So we capture ratings, we put out reports, we do those things. The next thing we do, we take requests. You come in to the diner, you want a burger, you get a burger made. People come in, they ask us questions and we create things and figure out how to answer their questions. And then the last thing that we do that I think puts us over the top is as we begin to build a rapport with our stakeholders and we begin to understand what delights them, what keeps them up at night, share their burdens with them, then there are those moments that they come in and I'll take you back to the diner where you go into this diner every day, you always ask for breakfast, you get to know the people behind, what's going on, and you're complaining this morning that oh, I'm not going to get lunch on Friday. It's going to be a long day, blah, blah, blah. I can't wait till it comes, whatever. And when you come in that Friday, the guy hands you something extra that you didn't ask for. You're like, what's this? Just take it. And it's in that moment where lunchtime, your stomach's grumbling. You're like, wait a minute. And it's your favorite sandwich. So the last thing that we do when we do it really well is we answer questions that aren't necessarily asked directly. And so it was
You're anticipating,
always,
aren't you?
We're anticipating, but we're also participating. What I would tell my teams is, look, whether there's a direct need for research or not in a meeting, we always want our stakeholders to feel, the people that we serve and the company to feel like, wait a minute, where's somebody from research? Because they make the meeting better. It's like, we just want them in to hear. And sometimes when we're having our discussions, it's like, what was going on? What's everybody worried about? They're worried about X. It's like, let's add a tidbit of analysis. Or I've created things where I remember Kevin Riley complaining to the team about something and just saying, research puts out this really great report that does da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And
suddenly like, you're getting calls from every other area and I'm like, in Fox
and
saying,
like, yeah.
Right?
And he's like, where did that come from? It's like, well, you were in a meeting complaining and we sat down and sort of figured out how do we meet
wow.
this need that you didn't put out. And he was just sort of silent after that. But it's like, if we're doing our job, that's what
yes.
we do, you know.
And you had a very good working relationship with Kevin Riley and also Peter Liguori and Gail Berman.
Gail hired me at Fox. So
she's a very special woman.
She is one of the best storytellers that I've ever met. And then watching her go through the process with creatives and development is actually pretty.
Well, because she started in the theater.
Yeah. It's
producing
pretty,
a Broadway show, I think Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat
yes.
at like 21 years old or something.
It is amazing to watch her sort of see, understand a story and then sort of play it out. And so for us being inside, because you know, when I was at Disney Channel, we would make 15 movies a year. So that was a quick test. It was a quick test because the movies are formulaic, right? But when you make a show, it's like 20 movies, but it's all sort of one subject. And so what you're trying to figure out is how to give someone enough information to understand that the ride that they're going on or the how they want to lay out their stories, where the audience matters and where it doesn't. Gail was the first executive that I could actually observe sort of be able to think through 20 episodes or a season, the arcs. Because when you're talking about a movie, it's one and done. It's arcs across an hour.
Absolutely.
When you're talking about a series, you may be talking about an arc across 22 episodes.
I'm learning that now with the streamers, for example. When you look at a movie on streaming and a movie in a theater, you have to capture the audience in a different way. You have to grab them right away. And you can't have the same cold opening necessarily. Or if you don't have the same cold opening, you may lose the audience because they're so distracted by doing other things. Television always had that problem, if you will, is holding the audience until those commercial breaks and then gaining them back right afterwards.
So yes and no.
Tell me.
So the acts were built and we played fast and loose with the acts to make more money. So four-act drama series became five acts because you just made more money. Broadcast always had less commercial breaks than cable, which people don't realize. So when you actually, you know, I don't know if people are looking at Suits, which I think is on Netflix right now. There's not that many minutes inside of those hour dramas. There are literally seven, like there are multiple breaks because they ran so many more commercials than they did in broadcast television. You just had fewer breaks. That's the rub.
So like Lifetime has seven acts.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's crazy. Broadcast only always had five.
Yes.
What about now?
They haven't increased. They tried to go to six. It's difficult because writers writing in those breaks, it's a very difficult process because you're thinking about it. What you think about and you're teaching a writer to write in those breaks is you're thinking about – you think about it as a roller coaster, right? You want to take somebody up and right at that moment, you basically leave and give them –
You need to tease them.
And you give them time to catch their breath.
Right, right.
And they are waiting because it's a cliffhanger. I'll never forget talking to a colleague because 24, we would play – it's like we're going to run commercial free. 24 is a very difficult show to do that with because we literally did that. If you watch 24, it goes like that. It takes you all the way up. And I remember a colleague calling me. It's like, why the fuck did you take the breaks out? I kept waiting. My heart was going and going because remember, it's a roller coaster. We're just building up, building up.
So they said,
up.
Why did you take the –
Take the breaks out because I you know, it was too much. I needed to breathe.
Oh, wow.
In the storytelling. So you have to look at it sort of that way. Movies don't have that problem at all because there are no breaks. Yes, you do take people up
and
down.
Well, you have an act one and act two, act three structure
typically.
But you do
take people up and down because of the, whatever the narrative is. But in this 60 minutes, which if it's broadcast, it's 44. If it's cable, it's 42. Think about that. 42 minutes.
And now streaming could be anything. It's usually around 50.
Streaming, it's random with
it's
regard
random.
To streaming because you don't have normal breaks. If you did, it would
breaks.
Have you, it would help you with structure.
You don't have any breaks often.
Depending on who you're
so
selling
to. So there
are
mini movies in a way then, right?
Unless you're Hulu because you do have breaks.
Right.
So understanding that break structure is a part of it with regard to how you tell a story. But then also what I would tell people all the time is like, movies have stars. You know the actor in a movie. You know that Kiefer Sutherland is in whatever movie it is. But when you're talking about television, you're talking about characters. These are very personal to people. People say to you, you know what, Jack Bauer and I have a date tonight. And you know exactly who they're talking about because
it's
personal. You have to remember
that
whether you're talking about streaming or it doesn't, that's just a screen. It's a medium. If you're talking about television content, it's at home. It's personal. I'm watching it like Al Bundy with my, you know, these are my friends.
You're absolutely right.
Movies are story first, character second, and television is character first, story second, because I'm only going to watch if I care. And so it's one of five things. Oh, that's me. Oh, that's someone I know. Oh, that's someone I want to be. Oh, that's just like my brother, right? That guy reminds me of my neighbor.
It's a relatability.
It has to be.
Wow.
Or else you're not in it. So it doesn't matter with regard to story. It's like you only care if you're going to invest in this person to stay with them for five episodes because you like them. You want to hang out with them.
Speaking of likability, there is a historic show that you were involved with that probably is an example of the best casting maybe ever in television, a show called Friends. And you were at NBC at the time. And The rumor is that Friends never tested well, which I don't think is actually true, but it didn't test spectacularly well. A lot of the creators now like to say, oh, it was almost killed by the audiences. Can you talk about that experience?
When we talk about show testing on the broadcast television side, which is very different than happening cable, those deals are made. And when you're talking about the audience, usually you're testing two or three shows to figure out a whole host of things. How do we sell this? What are we doing with this? Because you've made the decision to move forward. It's not a pilot test.
That's on cable.
That's on cable. The pilot test, what would happen is the networks would make 20 some odd shows, and they're only going to pick up four or five. So the pilot test is about figuring out if there's some there, can I move forward? So you make a set of norms, you do a quantitative test. So Friends was at norm. And getting people to understand when something's at norm, that's just average.
Let me just tell listeners, how many shows have we seen in our careers that have been average and they make it on the air?
So the best story is Seinfeld. When I got to NBC, I was given the pilot test for Seinfeld, for Miami Vice, and for something else. And I looked at all of the pilots. The Miami Vice pilot was like, oh my God, I can't believe they tested this because it's dark. And I understood why the test read that it did.
It didn't go well.
It was average. It was average. None of these things tested poorly. If they tested poorly, they are not picked up, right? And I'll define poorly because there are shows that have gone on to be wildly successful that tested average. What was that show? The Office had a 50% rejection rate, but of the people that loved it, of the top box and the people that tested it, that loved the show, it was broad. And so that was an indicator, like it was in the top percentile in terms of they were incredibly passionate about it, and it wasn't a narrow group of people. That's huge. If I'd said, oh, the top percentile of people that love the show is only one demographic, one sector of the audience, it wouldn't have been enough. But there's this passionate group of people that's a broad swath. And so when you look at the scores, Carell and all of that, then it was just a matter of, okay, we've seen this before. Seinfeld is the example. You have to learn how to watch the show. So here's the thing that people forget. When Seinfeld premiered on air, Home Improvement used to kick its ass on the regular. Louis Dreyfus was not in the pilot. It was three guys. Right?
She wasn't in the pilot.
No. So Seinfeld was Friends' family, if you will. So remember, there's a finite number of stories that we tell, right? And so whether it's redemption or whatever, Seinfeld was just a buddy comedy, but it was a buddy comedy among three.
About nothing.
What would happen in Seinfeld, because if you look at Three's Company, it's the same thing. The problem would be presented, and then the entire episode is all the calamities until you get down to the end, and it's like, let's solve it. If you look at the last season of Seinfeld, in the very last episode, because they're all unlikable, and that was the thing that made it remarkable, it's very rare that you can have four unlikable people, because the audience, who do you attend? Like four unlikable people. And in the last episode, which is why most people didn't get it, the last episode they went to jail. They were punished for being not nice people, but there was four unlikable people.
Wow.
Think about the people that you know as friends, the people you don't like, you want to spend a limited amount of time with them, a very limited amount of time. It's like, I have no reason to cheer for you. Think about it. Television is personal. And so Home Improvement on the other side was just easier to digest. It's like half the time you didn't know what they were talking about. So let's think about how long they left it on the air. They left it on the air to get enough episodes to go into syndication, and it went into Prime Access. So across the country, Seinfeld is now on Prime Access, and you're watching it 5 days a week at dinner waiting. The country now is learning how to watch the show.
And that's what you meant about learning
how
to watch the show.
And so then they begin to understand, oh, Kramer reminds me. Oh, now, I can identify.
Did you know that
people.
You got that early on?
What happened
it's such an astute observation.
So when we would talk to kids about shows, we did a shorts project. We called our shorts What a Cartoon. And so I travel around the country because whenever I do focus groups, it's a way. And focus groups for children are quite honest. So we're going to show the Powerpuff Girls. And Craig McCracken, who created it, was 19 at the time. And I had a huge fight with Fred Seibert. It's like, he cannot come to the focus groups. It's like, dude, kids are brutal. We're going to put the show on anyway, but we just need to understand
how to position it or
how to talk about it.
How to socialize it.
Correct. So Craig is in Arizona with me and the kids are like, oh my God, they're second graders. They have no hands. Just awful, right? He's in a fetal position.
Oh, no.
I have to get him drunk in this amazing bar in this amazing hotel that we're staying in. I'm like, dude, we're going to do your show. We just need to understand how to deal with kids.
You can't tell
with
a creator that. You just can't.
But it began to help me understand how to interpret how people were responding to things. And so the kids were picking it apart because they didn't have anything grounding. It looked very different. They just didn't know what to make of it. It wasn't hugely successful, but we had to explain it.
We have to understand how the audience is actually going to consume it. When we come back, I want to talk about Friends because we never got there because we got sidetracked with Seinfeld and Home Improvement. We'll be back in a moment.
Get a glimpse into a secret part of Hollywood that few are aware of and that filmmakers rarely talk about. In the new book, Audienceology by Kevin Getz. Each chapter is filled with never-before-revealed inside stories and interviews from famous studio chiefs, directors, producers, and movie stars, bringing the art and science of audienceology into focus. Audienceology, how moviegoers shape the films we love. From Tiller Press at Simon & Schuster. Available now.
We're back with Melva Benoit, a terrific executive, strategist, marketing genius, in my opinion, and research phenom. So, Mel, I want to talk about Friends again. What happened with the testing of that at first? It tested averagely, you said.
It tested average, and it was the same thing in terms of Friends as family. It was how it was communicated,
What does that mean, Friends as family?
So it was basically a family comedy. It wasn't a buddy comedy, which is very different. Seinfeld was more like a buddy comedy. Friends was more like a family comedy in terms of you had six people that related to each other almost like siblings. And so if you think about how family comedies work, it really played much more so like a family comedy. And so we call that Friends as family, right? So Friends as family, buddy comedies are very different. Buddy comedies are these two people oftentimes are opposites. These guys were really like six siblings in all of their shenanigans that happen. All of the characters popped except one, and I'm not going to tell you which one. You could probably guess. So
I would say Phoebe.
Yeah. I don't necessarily know why. You could even see it in the ratings because they move the stories around in terms of who had the
And then
A,
she was
B,
ultimately
C.
so embraced, right?
I think sort of like Joey, she was more of a spice.
More of a foil.
Correct. And Joey sort of the same way. In the last year, Kevin came over and Kevin really wanted to do the Joey show. You know, that was the spinoff of Friends. And Frasier came out of Cheers. And it's like, yes, but Frasier is a completely different show. You want Joey to still be Joey without the friends. And Joey doesn't work without the friends.
Yeah.
It was really difficult to sort of figure that out.
You saw it in the pilot or you started audiences?
But they were going to do it. They're going to do it no matter
what. Let's talk about the audience for a second a little bit because you and I have a great reverence for audiences. We have made our livings listening and advocating to and for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question is, you made a good comment before about like there's a point at which no low testing pilot ever makes it on air. I completely agree with that. We have a lot of data to support that. And whenever something might have gone on air, it would be for a business or political decision made outside of the audience's approval, if you will,
mm-hmm.
right? Or support, or ours.
Mm-hmm.
It was above our pay grades.
Right.
Then you look at medium testing pilots, which are, I would probably say are half of them, if not more,
mm-hmm.
that are – and then you have really strong testing pilots that not necessarily make it on air, but if they do, don't necessarily succeed. So can you speak of an example that tested extremely highly that either really worked or really didn't?
Yeah, I can give both. I mean, basically, television is about 80% failure. You know, it's a portfolio strategy. Everything can't be a home run. There'll be a home run, and then you want to get supporting players because you're building a schedule, if you will. You're building a playlist, if you will. If you're a streamer, you're building a playlist. I need the one show to drag everybody here, and then I'm going to use the algorithm to force them into other things, because if I'm a streamer, the strategy is I got to keep them paying.
Let's go back full circle now.
Yep.
I introduced you as a terrific marketing executive, but what I said is in 2016, Screen Engine partnered with you, Melva, to initiate a way to stop looking at U.S. Census as the primary, it's not unimportant, definition of a consumer of entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was born out of the fact that you and I don't know if we were at dinner or lunch or drinks or whatever the hell we were. I'm a Caucasian gay male. You're a African-American straight woman. We share so many of the same program likes. Mm-hmm. And yet we would not be marketed to each other's.
We would respond to the same messaging.
We could come together because of our sensibility, mm-hmm. because of our human values, our behavior, our background, our education,
yes.
our income levels. No, I mean, seriously, all these mm-hmm. things make us who we are, and most of it is lost because of this archaic way of looking and classifying people. And I think the fact that you are classifying people in buckets is a really dangerous thing, rather than creating and exploiting all of those great ways that the streamers are actually finding people now through their likes and their sensibilities. I find that absolutely fascinating. And I would almost go so far as to say a way that has to happen in order to survive
mm-hmm.
the next wave of advertising. Talk to me about that. That's so important to people to hear and understand.
So the belief with data, and I'm going to go in two ways. The belief with data was that targeted advertising would get better. The reality is targeted advertising hasn't gotten better. And part of that is for the reason that you talked about.
Well, it has in
– No, it actually hasn't.
Digital?
No, that's what I said. I missed oftentimes for content that –
But it's gotten better. Is what I mean.
No, the promise of targeted advertising was that we would use the data and really go. The problem is because the first way you begin to sort of think about targeting is exactly as you said, age, ethnicity, like all of those things. And so then you miss some nuance in other data. And it part of it has to do with models being built by people that are all in a single group, if you will, that actually don't think sort of much more broadly about things. The example that I give sometimes, my daughter is a very eclectic and broad taste, the 16-year-old. She found the bear because it showed up in her feed on social. And then she said, Mom, I have a show for us to watch. And we sat down on Hulu, and that's how we watched The Bear the first season. But The Bear, which is a perfect show for me, has never shown up. And I watched The Bear, I've watched both seasons, has not shown up in anything that comes to me on my phone, none of my social, nothing. And I am the perfect candidate because I'm already watching it. Right. So you can actually see that because my name is on Hulu, but they don't find me in targeting. I don't know why I don't show up in the algorithm, which is fascinating to me because it's like, wait a minute, am I completely out of the demo that I don't get anything coming at me because I'm watching this stuff? They know I'm watching this stuff.
What a missed opportunity.
But that's where the old thinking around who, where, and what. And I'm sure I probably get screened out because of age, because of where I'm living, you know, things that are normal
even,
as opposed to, wait a minute, she likes this kind of, because you know, you have that information
we
on
did
me.
A, last night we did a screening of a documentary
mm-hmm.
and the filmmaker said something like, well, I sat with a New York Times, ex-New York Times critic, and we were looking at the people who were,
mm-hmm.
And they were not people who watched those documentaries.
Well,
and you know what that means. People don't understand. What our brief was called was the new majority brief.
Yep.
And that this country is turning in the 2040s to the entire country becoming more minorities, current what we deem as minority groups.
Mm-hmm. Country's getting browner, right.
Exactly. And we are not representative of that so often. I'm trying to reframe that conversation. I'm asking you Do you think there's a way to change the ad industry to come around to our way of thinking? Because it really requires almost the U.S. Census to not have the U.S. Census as the principal measurement, but rather a segmentation of Americans so that we can use that as the basis for buying data and for buying advertising, because that's really what it comes down to, is a dollars and cents issue, does it not?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I've thought about this for a little while. So going back historically with the census and this small example, growing up in Texas and Houston, when I became school-aged, we weren't segregated. We were integrated. When my mother was coming up in Houston, it was all segregated. And desegregation happened because she was a part of that in 1967, the year my brother was born. One of the things that they would do in looking at census information to basically how the money moved was they would count Hispanics as white. So understand what I'm saying. The way demographers have sort of evolved those things is sort of what drives those numbers, which don't necessarily reflect what the country looks like. But we know for a fact that the country is getting browner. We know for a fact that a number of mixed race people, that number has grown. We know for a fact, because births were going down in particular, that there were just more coming through.
I have studio executives that have walked into movie screenings and said, this is not representative of the audience. And so, I said, well, it's representative of Los Angeles. Let me tell you that.
Correct.
African-American in Los Angeles is probably close to U.S. Census, but it's only 6% in the state.
Right.
So I'm saying, this is exactly – who do you think is showing up?
Correct.
You know, and they want a sea of white people, I'm sorry to say. And because, it's like – and but no movie, almost no movie, with the exception of certain art house films, have 60 or 70% – Caucasian makeup. Most general wide release movies, the Caucasian numbers are in the 40%, below the U.S. Census, again signifying that we must reach people through their shared attitudes and behaviors.
The bubble that is Los Angeles was always sort of funny to me, and Fox was not exactly A County. So it would always be funny to me when we would show people watching and executives would kind of move around, because it's like they're not seeing a reflection of themselves because they believe that they represent the U.S. It's like, not, dude, we're like a C and D county network. What is wrong with you?
I remember you asking me to take video of people that were interviewed. Remember we did those because you wanted to prove to your executives that this is what it looks like in St. Louis, and it's very diverse.
LaGuardia just liked to
Peter
punish
LaGuardia,
them. Yeah, he would take them to some awful place and say, this is our audience, FX, and it would be some podunk town that they indexed really high. But for me, I would have to remind people, look, we're not even on 7 days a week, 3 hours a night. We have less programming than everyone. So we don't have daytime. We don't have all of those things. So we have to rely on whatever is in the market. And when they heard people say, no one says Fox, they would say Fox 11, Fox 26. And they would
then
talk about.
You created more than any other network, a brand.
Well,
I would say you, and it's followed by CBS.
So let's go through the brands. So I started at King World. I went to Cartoon Network 3 months after they launched, and so that was building a brand. I can remember in our first attitude and usage study building, which I had four-year-olds to like 60-year-olds taking a survey in a mall with a computer, so babysitting on their mom's lap with a trackball, answering questions that were spoken to them with smiley faces. So that's my very first major quantitative study.
We basically do
study.
That now with emojis.
Exactly. So think about that. That's so I'm going back to 1994. That's
everything,
my
everything
very
old
first.
Is new again.
Yeah, it's my first study. So remember talking to some kids, and it's like, oh, Cartoon Network is just – it's the stuff in between the shows is better than the shows. It's all old. And so we made – what's the brand? What are we? And what we decided was Cartoon Network was going to be a destination, and what we wanted kids to believe that every cartoon, whether it was on Nickelodeon, Warner Brothers, every cartoon came from Cartoon Network. And that was the job for a year. until kids came finally came back, and it's like, no, Cartoon Network is responsible for every cartoon, every single one.
Wow, that's
it's like, incredible. Well, what would happen if we took it on the air? And I remember a kid saying, well, I call the president. So that was amazing. So jump there to Comedy Central, where it's like, okay, what do we want Comedy Central to be? So we're going to basically turn a brand around. And we were doing this work. So funny. We're doing this work, you know, projection techniques. And so we're asking people, okay, if Comedy Central is a person, describe them. And so they're all like, oh, Comedy Central is a man. It's a comedian. He's kind of old. He's got shades on. And he's like the old guy in the club. And we're like, we have to figure this out because we don't want to be the old guy in the club. So we created a show, which people see now, called The Daily Show. I think Craig Kilborn was the host at the time. What I had to do to get the creators in the room, they're like, so we have this offsite, and Melva's going to take you through the research. This is what's going to happen. And I'm like, look, guys, collaborative process. She's like, wait, Melva, before you start, look, we're all really smart, funny people. Why do we need to talk to the audience? Okay, you can go now. I'm like,
oh, no.
Okay, I'm prepping them for research. I had to bring a masseuse, allow her to smoke cigarettes. There was caviar with creme fraiche. And as the masseuse is working on the knot, I said, look, here's the thing. And this is the magic and the beauty of focus groups. Oftentimes you're thinking about changes of the show or how people are responding and you have questions and you think you know the answer. Let's hear the audience confirm what you're already thinking. Because maybe you'll hear one thing that'll be an aha moment. But for the majority of it, it'll just make you feel better because you were already thinking these things. So we knew some of the changes that we wanted to make. But as the focus groups got going and I saw the producer sort of sit up, and it's like everything from it's like, why doesn't the host laugh, to all of the confirmation came through.
You had to train them.
But all of the confirmation came through. That it was suddenly like focus groups were the greatest thing ever. When can we do them again? And then jump forward to now I'm going to moderate focus groups, and I've stacked the deck, and I have nobody over 25 for South Park. They're all animation lovers. We've been working on this show for 9 months. We think it's the funniest thing ever. And they all watch it. And then, okay, pencils down. It's like, okay, the pads are passed out. It's like, okay, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 means you loved it. 1 means you hated it. And then write down 2 things you liked about it, 2 things you hate. Okay, pencils down. Let's go around the room. And here we go. 1 -7, 2, 3 -20. And the color's draining from my face because it's like, okay.
But it's a terribly testing show. How did it get on
and
air?
So then it's like, what's your favorite thing about it? That it ended. And we go through it. And in the focus groups, I could see they're just picking it apart. Like, there's nothing I could say to get something constructive. And then I take a plane ride. I get on the red eye to go back to New York. And it's like, what just happened? And as I'm sitting there trying to understand what they were saying, it's like, they don't know how to watch this. We've been sitting with the show for 9 months. It's everything that we tell people when they've made a show. It's like, you know everything about it. There was no preamble. They're seeing it for the first time. It's something I remember telling Jeff Zucker. It's like, when I meet you for the first time and you tell me a dirty joke, probably not going to see you again. But if you and I are friends and we've gotten to know each other and you tell me the same joke, oh my God, it's the funniest thing ever.
Oh, that's genius.
And so there was a moment in the pilot episode where Cartman is taken up by the aliens and Kyle does one of his first speeches, and then he curses for like, and we run a beep for like, I don't know, like a full 20 seconds.
And you're just so turned off.
And we're like, this is the funniest thing ever. And they're just like, the fuck is this? And so we realize it's like, we have to tell people how to watch this. It's like peanuts on acid. We cannot give any this to anybody cold. So think about this. This is 1996, 1997. So we released the Jesus versus Santa Claus, which is what this is based off. We released it on the, would be called the internet.
The web. The World Wide Web.
Back then.
The intranet.
Which means it goes.
The intranet.
The intranet, which means it goes to every college campus, think about how it works. Sure. So that's the first viral video. When that show showed up, it changed the fortunes of the network. It took us from being barely breaking even to, it was the biggest thing ever.
Oh, my God. Well, Melva Benoit, what can I say? You're just brilliant and insightful and curious and talented. And I have loved working with you over these last over two decades. And so happy to call you a friend. Thanks for coming on today.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's wonderful. And more to come.
To our listeners, I hope you enjoyed the interview today. For more stories like this, I invite you to check out my book, Audienceology, at Amazon or through my website at kevingetz360.com. You can also follow me on my social media at kevingetz360. Next time on Don't Kill the Messenger, I'll welcome the accomplished veteran producer, executive, educator, and author of the book Creative Producing, Carol Baum. Until then, I'm Kevin Getz, and to you, our listeners, I appreciate you being part of the movie-making process. Your opinions matter.